You're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast where we discuss classic works of management and organization studies. Welcome to episode 57, where we are discussing Stephen Kerr's article on the folly of rewarding A while hoping for B. Originally published in the Academy of Management Journal in 1975, and then updated in Academy of Management Perspectives in 1995. To get the text and for more information, please visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. This is Tom, coming from Carlisle, Pennsylvania, in the United States.
This is Ella, coming to you from Amsterdam in the Netherlands.
This is Michael, coming to you from Utrecht, also in the Netherlands.
And this is Fridtjof, this time not coming from the Netherlands, but actually coming from Santorini, where I'm taking in some days of sun, water, and Greek food just before I will go to Pros in a bit.
And that sounds like a wonderful thing. What you been doing there so far?
Santorini is a really an experience. It's so overrun. But it's amazingly beautiful. You've all seen probably the pictures with all the white buildings and the blue roofs, and it's just as pretty as on the pictures. It's breathtaking. Nice. But it's also very overrun and very expensive.
Well, that's okay. It still sounds like a great place to go after after a long year at the university.
Oh yes, just in time for the conference.
Okay, so we have a very interesting article here titled On the Folly of Rewarding A While Hoping for B. And we have two versions of it available to us. It was originally published in 1975 and then updated in 1995. Yeah. It's rather fascinating. Anybody want to give a quick overview of what the article is about?
Sure. So I'm excited to discuss this article today. And like Tom said, there's two versions of it. So I think we'll be iterating a little bit between the two. They're not too dissimilar, but in the second version in 1995, we get the inside scoop that this article was almost not published. So it was rejected initially, and then the reviewers didn't like the tone, because it's quite engaging, it's quite conversational, and so it was adjusted a little bit, but the editor finally broke the tie between the reviewers and let it through, which I think we're quite grateful of. And I'm going to briefly outline why this article is such a classic. So my reading of why this is such a famous article and a classic is because we actually see a lot of seemingly irrational behavior in organizations. And that often leaves us as employees or as scholars scratching our heads. We're trying to figure out why things are not working out the way they're supposed to. And this article gives some insight into why that might be in certain situations. So questions that you might have, like, why do some faculty, some university staff, not make time for teaching or put value in teaching when that's their job? Or why would doctors over-prescribe medicines? They give out a lot of medicine often when people are not really that ill, when they know the risks of that. Why does that happen? Or why would the army allow soldiers to go home if they're sick, when you don't really want sick or injured soldiers? So these are the sorts of circumstances that Kerr interrogates, and he does that by reminding us that it's to do with the reward system. So often organizations ostensibly or have this claimed goal, which they say they're rewarding, but actually if you look below the surface, they're rewarding some other behavior that is not desirable. And this happens in lots of different contexts, organizational, societal, and he says that these reward systems that don't work, they're fouled up. And so a system pretends to want one thing, but it's actually rewarding another thing that undermines the stated or claimed goal. And he says there are four reasons for why this might happen. Fascination with an objective criterion. So whatever you can kind of state as one number, for example, that's what gets a lot of attention. Or an overemphasis on highly visible behaviors. And here, from my own research, I'm definitely drawn to the idea of presenteeism, that people show up, put in long hours at the office, but aren't necessarily contributing anything to the organization's goals. And people go, well, why is productivity not high? Well, because you are rewarding, perhaps through your boss's informal cues or perhaps in a formal review system, the act of just showing up at the office. And these two examples are where the reward system is genuinely fouled up. There's some sort of mistake in the logic. But there are other situations where you might get these problems, and they're actually to do with something else. So there might just be hypocrisy. So this means that actually the person is saying that they want A, but actually they want B, and that is what they're rewarding. And an example might be innovation. A lot of companies say they want their employees to be innovative, that they reward risk-taking, but actually they would prefer for everyone to just do as they're told and to maintain the status quo. And finally, it might be that actually there are really good reasons for not pursuing the stated goal. For example, morality or equality might actually be more important than efficiency. But the person who's complaining about the reward system emphasizes efficiency above all else. So from their perspective, something's going wrong. So then we can kind of diagnose the underlying problem. And the appealing idea here is that if you can identify this perverse behavior and how it is being rewarded, that you might actually be able to intervene, change the reward structure, and that will fix the situation. So that is a very appealing notion that we just need to work out what's going on and make the system more logical and rational. So I think that's why it's stood the test of time. I'm looking forward to discussing this with you all today. I'm sure that there are lots of examples that you can think of yourselves where this has gone on. So I'm really keen to hear your impressions.
Well, it's just kind of striking to me that he would say that in 1995, 20 years later, because, I mean, when we really think about it, 1975 was not a time when these sorts of behaviors were thought about or discussed to the same extent. And by the time that we get to 1995, there are so many people looking at irrationality by comparison that, maybe it seemed obvious to him. But it was really striking to me the way in which he built his arguments very efficiently. I mean, this is a short article covering a wide variety of contexts from academia, from the public sector, from the private sector. The same patterns of behavior expressed in different types of problems, different types of decisions. And that to me is certainly explains why it has such appeal. I mean, I did a little internet search before we started recording, and the metaphor of reward systems and rewarding the wrong thing is very pervasive in what a lot of consultants today are now trying to help organizations stop doing. I mean, this is a pervasive, persistent problem.
I agree, Tom. It's around on the internet the whole system of the reward system, but also the mentioning of the article itself in more popular outlets. So it is an academic or a management classic, and in a way, I was also wondering why, because it is a short article. It gives a lot of examples, but it's not a very common academic article. And that's actually what he reflects on in the revised edition, that, like Ella mentioned. So what to me is appealing on the article is the tone of voice that Kurz sets in the article. It's conversational, but it's also critical, ironic. In a way. And then in this revised version from 95, he actually writes, well, the copy editor of the first version strangled some of the life from my writing style. And that's interesting because it already has quite a lively writing style, but in a way he wanted to get more out of it. Through this more uncommon way of writing and stressing the argument, so as it is an uncommon writing style, an uncommon article, it's actually very interesting that exactly this one has popped up as a management classic.
And when I was reading this, I was thinking, wouldn't this today go more into like an HBR or Sloan or whatever article? Because I personally, I like this style of writing. I think it refreshes us a bit on different ways of writing, different ways of making a point. At the same time, because it is written like this, it's almost colloquial, as in maybe that's kind of like the reason why it gets picked up so easily by other people as a metaphor to use as a way of looking at these things, because it's written so easy. But at the same time, I was a bit surprised that it's a classic for management scholars, as in it made it sound all so obvious, and of course it's not that obvious, it's not that simple. For example, like one of the things that I missed was like why does this come about? So yeah, in hindsight, saying that yeah this is not working, yeah okay that's one thing, but the different thing is trying to explain okay, but why did somebody ever think this system up? And I don't know what you guys think, but
Well, I think that's kind of the importance about putting the article in context, say in 1975, where I interpret the article as sort of like a proposal, hey, I'm seeing this in a whole bunch of contexts. Nobody's talking about it. Is this something we need to talk about? That was kind of how I took it, which is kind of why, you know, now certainly an article like this would not appear in, say, the Academy of Management now, because it is something that's a phenomenon that people have studied. And so now we have to acknowledge the history as we do the literature surveys and that. And you know, it becomes a different type of a piece. I agree. Nowadays, something like this might be more likely in a Harvard Business Review or similar type of a journal. But, you know, I think that just may have been a matter of the scholarship at the time. As far as the colloquial tone, I agree too. I really like it. I find it refreshing. I find it, very engaging. But it's also a matter of, you know, this is a very, very complex, wide-reaching problem. And you almost have to hit the wave tops of it in order to be able to cover as much ground as he did, from politics to war to education. You see what I mean?
Yeah, and that's actually what I did like about the article, that he was using so many different contexts to make his point. I think that's in a way also the strength of the article, that he talks about these the similar phenomenon, the same phenomenon in such different contexts, to show that it's not just something to do with this specific context, but it's something more general. But yes, indeed, I think most scholars would have difficulties having the access, having the experience in such different contexts to really make a meaningful point there.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, the number of examples, the number of contexts that he discusses, I mean, it shows the wide-ranging well workings of this phenomenon. Yet there's also a weakness in it, because he drops the examples in a way and discusses them rather briefly, and then pops on to the next one. And that's so I have to agree with Fridtjof, who earlier remarked also that what's the background of these this phenomenon. And I think there is the article in need of more explanation on the specific examples he works out. But in itself, the number of examples is very convincing in showing that the phenomenon is very real.
Yeah, it almost feels more like a speech. You know, if you did this as a talk, it would come across as very rich, because you could imagine all of these examples. But the examples really are being used in quite a stylized, almost a caricature way to back up his overall argument. And it is very compelling, but I suppose there's something a bit dangerous in that as well, because without the rich detail that would give the history, as you're saying, of these different examples, we're left with a reiteration of his message. And his message at core is quite Skinnerian. It's has some assumptions about human behavior that are quite simplistic and that, well, especially today, we could very much challenge. It doesn't allow for things really like agency. It very much assumes that people just respond to the systems and to the rewards that are offered to them. So there's so much that's skirted over. And yet that leads to the simplicity of the argument, which makes it carry across time and contexts so effectively, which is probably also why it's used a lot in consulting, because it's a message that is probably going to be useful or at least to some extent illuminating in so many different organizational contexts as well. So it seems to be a trade-off there between its simplicity, but perhaps at the expense of some rigor.
Yeah, is it simplicity or is it the power of sticking to the rational choice theory and well, using that really as your explanational model? For him, I think it was the strength of it, and yet it skews away a lot of other factors, of course, that are relevant for organization and management.
Yeah, on the other hand, it certainly offers a framework for further exploration. And one of the things that I was internet searching on too was, where did I see this same sort of, where either Kerr was directly cited or maybe some follow-on works were directly cited in terms of, you know, contemporary issues. And for example, I came across one that argues about how grading, for the intention of using grades as incentives for better academic performance, actually can have the opposite effect or drive students to do behaviors that serve to maximize the grades but don't necessarily maximize their learning experience. In this particular article, obviously, trying to cover wide range of territory and provide something that can be explored further. You know, it's a simple approach that, okay, with all of these contexts, let's say political science, higher education administration, all of these other fields who are essentially being challenged in this, you know, go forth and do the studies, go do your empirical research, go into the details and see if I'm right. That's kind of what I think has happened, and because the basic thesis of the problems of the reward system keep being demonstrated over and over again is why this article has been enduring.
Definitely, and I also find it quite useful for action. For example, when I'm setting up a course, and you know, you're writing up the course manual, and you have certain decisions to make. Implicitly, I'm thinking about this article and going, okay, what am I actually rewarding if I put in this incentive? And is it what I actually see as the wider aim of the course or what I'm trying to achieve here as a teacher? So when questions come up like, well, attendance at lectures is poor, so what are we going to do about that? Are we going to make attendance at lectures compulsory? Those sort of decisions, which it's a real conundrum. But then if you think through this article and you go, well, we don't want to reward people just showing up because that's a visible behavior that we can record and turn into a number. But what we're actually going to end up with is disengaged students in a room. I mean, that's not the idea of a lecture. So we wouldn't be achieving what we are setting out to achieve with that. So that kind of reasoning, it might sound simple, but you can so easily end up with a system that's rewarding the wrong things. So this helps me to think that through, which makes it practical.
Yeah, and that's actually what I like about this article, that maybe it was just me reading it into it, but it had a bit of a holistic idea in it that, say, for example, the examples about the World War II versus Vietnam, that World War II, so to say, by design already was a different kind of war than the Vietnam War, which led to very different behavior, and that you have to really think about the consequences of your choice in rewarding this or rewarding this down the line, and that you also sort of say need to reflect later as you progress after I've made the choice, we're going to reward this in order to achieve that, and that you reflect on, okay, is this actually working as intended? And that these kind of things, these kind of social systems are much more complex than maybe initially thought with the initial reward program. And that indeed, so with the example of the students, yeah, you can force them to be there, but is that really what you want in the end? And then usually that's not actually really what you want.
Yeah, and I think the example of the warfare is I think it's also quite compelling, specifically because of the comparative example in this specific case. So compare between the reward system between World War II and the Vietnam War really, I think, helped him explain his argument, because it's really upfront in the article. It takes the reader immediately towards the idea of a system that gives certain forms of behavior. While it isn't necessarily the system itself isn't necessarily a rational choice. So I think that's a strong opener example for his article, and it's. I think it would be interesting to see if the other examples also could, have comparative elements. I mean, the university system or the medicine system. What if we do things differently? And he doesn't really work those out in such a comparative way. But that might even show in a further way how the reward system influences these behaviors.
Well, I almost want to start with an even more fundamental question: is what is a reward? Because what we're actually talking about in terms of the reward, the actual outcome desired. Means something very, very differently in a lot of these contexts. And the war example, I think, is really fascinating because, yes, if you do a direct snapshot comparison, say, between World War II and Vietnam, I can certainly see where his argument comes from. Now, if you position yourself in at the point of decision where we had to come up with a personnel policy that ensured adequate manning in the war. Now, what we would perceive, say, in 1965, 1966, whatever the year was, as what was the right incentives that applied to World War II, it was 22, 23 years after the fact. Our hindsight might be a little bit flawed. So what we thought was perhaps a proper reward or incentive sometimes can change perspective over time. And that can contribute, I think, sometimes to a skewed decision. The idea that, for example, soldiers who went to war in World War II became exhausted, became high stress, could obviously have contributed to the decision to use a different type of a manning policy. I think time between what we're comparing rewards and incentives again is a factor here.
Definitely. There's probably so much context, and your point about hindsight is spot on, Tom, because there's so much you can leave out when you're telling this story about something that happened a long time ago, and all that is distilled from it is this message about a fouled up reward system when there's usually so many more complications. But it's interesting how much it's those kinds of stories that travel and persist. It's almost more like a myth or an allegory that people find comforting or insightful rather than something that is empirically grounded in the complexity of the situation. And I was interested to hear your perspective on the war story, because he almost leaves it with the implicit message that the way that they did things earlier was better, that soldiers had to stay in the war until the war ended, as if that was a preferable option. And he qualifies that a little bit towards the end. But I thought that was a strange message to come away with.
Yeah, I took it as such as well, because indeed, when you're in total war, those types of considerations just don't come into play. Your nation is fighting for its very survival, and it's whatever means are necessary. Vietnam was a different political decision, and therefore a lot of military decisions, a lot of other decisions followed from that. And that's the case no matter what, not just war, any type of a national emergency. Is this something that's going to essentially, or basically, is this an existential threat to our nation, or is this something else? And then, you know, if it is something else, then there's probably a lot more room for interpretation, a lot more room for discussions of scope, which can lead to, you know, ambiguity, can lead to different perspectives looking at things differently, which can then result in inconsistent rewards and incentives.
That word ambiguity, I think, is important because this perspective assumes that there is an underlying unified rational goal that this whole collective, or at least the steerers of it, are trying to achieve. And yet now, especially, we know that that's so rarely the case. It's interesting that the message still has appeal, even though we now know so much more about how complex organizational systems are, and that you're rarely going to have this agreement about what everyone's trying to achieve, which therefore leads to an almost impossibility of having your reward system align directly with those aims.
Yet while that's true, I think it's interesting that the causes that he cites still seem to persist despite our greater knowledge of complexity of organizations. I mean, that was the first thing that struck me
with
the fascination of objective criterion. That by itself, I mean, you think about, you know, how can some of these behaviors that we see that Kerr wrote in 1975, updated 1995, still persist because of fascination with objective criterion, something that we can measure. And it's almost like a driving philosophy. It's like in several change efforts that I know that I've seen, the drive to find things that are measurable in order to measure what is really essentially not measurable, that drive, that desire really can be very, very strong. If you're in an organization that depends on empiricism to drive decision-making.
And I love that even in the early article, he acknowledges that this is an illusion, this objective criterion, that it's always the result of subjective decisions or inputs having been concealed or in some way put to the background in order to reveal this objective criterion, whether it's an employee engagement score or some kind of final assessment on who is a better candidate, whatever it is, that there is subjectivity there, but we'll conceal it for the sake of this objective criterion.
Now, what did you all think of his third one? Ella didn't mention the four criteria at the end, but didn't explain hypocrisy. What do you all think of that particular cause?
Well, yeah, I think it also connects back to what you just said, because the hypocrisy, I think it's also a very still common and visible cause for these kind of flawed rewards systems, and he calls it the apple polishing, which to me was a new expression, so I had to Google it. What's apple polishing? But it's very clear that I think also when we use numbers or use the visible behaviors, often management as well as employees try to stress their performances in the most how do you say it most appealing ways, specifically when it's it underscores your prestige towards too much management or direction. He even has a very clear example and data on that in the article as well. When he discusses the manufacturing organization. So there he shows, based on the two departments of the organization, how lower levels employees try to, well, not disregard the management ideals, while management actually wants them to take risk and well. So I think it not only he mentions this as a cause, he also shows it in his limited amount of data in the article. But I guess it's very common and still applicable to modern practice.
The hypocrisy example resonated with me as well.
Just for me to check that I really understand.
Mm-hmm.
I was just trying to understand if I understand the hypocrisy part correctly. Do they mean that somebody has an actual goal but knows that they can't sort of say sell this goal because that's immoral or not ethical, whatever, and so they come up with a different reward that still will get them what they actually want, but they thought about, hey, but actually I'll use this one to actually get the other one. Is that what they mean, or is there something else? Because I don't understand his example of politicians' unwillingness to revise the penalties for disobedience of ecology laws, as if there's politicians that actually are willingly destroying the ecology. It's more that they, for other reasons, are not doing it, not now, not whatever. So I'm a bit confused here.
What you said about the inability to express the actual goal, I don't think it would be a matter of necessarily the real goal being immoral or unethical, but just simply being an alternative that might generate a negative reaction, might generate resistance to the idea. So it's almost like the reward system is designed to pursue an acceptable proxy for the actual goal in the hopes that the actual goal emerges, or something to that effect. But in any case, it's hypocrisy meant to highlight a difference between what one is espousing and what one is actually doing, which in this case is enacting a reward system that pursues a different angle than what one is saying is the real goal.
Yeah, that's how I understood it as well. There's an apparent contradiction. As an outsider, you look at it and you go, hang on, this doesn't make sense. There's a perverse incentive here. But when you understand what the actual goal is, then the conflict or the contradiction is resolved. It does actually make sense. It's just that the stated goal is not the actual goal.
Yeah, and there's definitely some work done and explanations of why that happens. And if you'll permit me, I'd like to just highlight some work done by Chris Argyris and organizational defenses, because he was basically telling a story in one of his books about his experience with a group of executives who were experiencing dysfunctional behavior. Basically, they were just. There was a lot of disagreements that everybody had about the ways to pursue improved organizational performance, but nobody seemed to want to say it. And what he traced it back to is, in some cases, it's a matter of protocols that the group behavior does not wish, or individual members of the group feel that it is better to not confront or to basically play nice with the group. I don't like that term, but I can't think of a better way to describe it. Rather than be confrontational, lay everything on the table, you know, have an argument or knock it out, and then move forward. And what that does is, because there is a certain risk aversion associated with it, then the real desired outcome or the real desired approaches never get on the table. And instead, we wind up with a group of people who are going to incentivize behaviors that nobody wants. So that's what I see in sort of underlying some of the political discussions, because the moment, for example, that a political leader makes a definitive statement about this is exactly what I'm going to do and why, that invites criticism from the political opponents. And if you don't want to generate, that kind of conversation, and you want to allow freedom to be able to pursue your goal, the best thing to do might be to withhold it and pursue a much more indirect approach. that can definitely come across as hypocritical if if you're taking an opposing or an alternative perspective.
I think it does. I'm thinking about bringing something else. So let me just do it. What I was wondering is how this talk about rewards relates to discussions about purpose and organizations. But this might be more something for the next section, right? Now that purpose becomes more important for organizations. So the idea that just having your reward system set up is maybe not sufficient. Just giving people a bonus is not sufficient. Maybe people need more than just rewards. Maybe they need something, a bigger goal for the organization to strive towards. So that, I don't know, if you're flipping burgers, that maybe at some point you think, hey, you know, I might get a bonus if I flip more burgers, but maybe what's the whole point of flipping burgers in this world? That's what I mean.
But I think that connects to the point Tom also makes by introducing archers here. So if there's no discussion on what are the outcomes desired for this organization, what are the goals of this organization, so then there is also, you might say, no learning, of course, for which we know archers. So the hypocrisy here, or that the reward system, by staying to these play nice groups and staying on the numbers, staying on the highly visible behaviors, keeps the organization away from deeper level of rewards, you might say, and from also higher learning objectives as a whole, I would say.
Well, in addition, I think Fretchoff with the burger flipping, I think is another good example of, say, how the reward system is definitely perceived. If you're talking about a large organization, where what makes sense in terms of incentives strategically for the organization don't necessarily translate or disaggregate down to the individual level. And I know in my organization, you know, when we're talking about a large military organization, those sorts of challenges come up routinely, where we're trying to incentivize some sort of a foreshaping activity that involves the entire force of millions, hundreds of thousands or millions of people. And you set up a rewards or incentives to try to shape the force. By the time it breaks down to individual decisions, first, what the greater rewards are for the large organization may not make sense at all. It may seem like this is not something that affects me. The other thing is that by the time that all of the individuals have digested and made their decisions, the outcomes may re-aggregate into something completely different from what the overall strategic organization wanted. And we run into that routinely when we're thinking about human resource decisions, because let's say that if you make a decision, and this is a present example from like 20, 25 years ago, when we tried to draw down after the Cold War, we made some shaping decisions that influenced or encouraged people to get out voluntarily, so we didn't have to force people to leave. What we ended up with, because of the way that people made decisions on whether to stay or whether to go, we ended up with a force that had way too many junior people, way too many senior people, but a bit of a gap in the middle. And so the reward system, because of that, you know, the hierarchical nature of the decision from the strategic to the individual, everybody was kind of doing the right thing, but the outcome came out wrong.
Yes, and leads me back to the whole idea of, on the one hand, that you need to sort of say stay attentive to the consequences of your choices regarding rewards, realizing that no amount of rational thinking beforehand will be able to predict everything afterwards. So you need to keep updating the reward system. And of course, more fundamentally, the whole idea of giving individuals rewards when actually you want organizational performance. you don't just want individuals to perform, but you want the organization as a whole to work. And that the whole splitting up the rewards into personal rewards, can only be of limited effect here.
Does he actually claim that, though, that this is about personal rewards specifically?
Not here, because
he did start the article by acknowledging that rewards are, I guess, relative. So everyone works out for themselves what a reward is. So I'm not sure that he's being too prescriptive about what that should look like in terms of what we often think of money or, I don't know, time off or these sort of simple terms. But maybe you can frame what seems like a reward to the individual as an organizational goal. If an individual is highly identified with an organization, they will see an organizational success as a personal success. Do you think that his framework allows for that kind of thinking, or is it more simplistic than that?
Well, I think it does. I think it's highly focused on alignment, his whole argument. So there should be, in a way, stressing like there should be an alignment between individual behavior and goals and organizational goals. At least that's how I read the piece.
Does he talk about rewards that are like at a group level? I didn't think so, but...
No, he doesn't. It's more that on the first page he says that the extent to which this occurs, of course, will depend on the perceived attractiveness of the rewards offered. So just from that, I'm taking a broader interpretation of what a reward is, because say if you're training animals, right? I have pet parrots. And so we read a bunch of books on how you train parrots. You can't just assume that what you think is a reward for the animal. You have to actually pay attention to what they seem to perceive as a reward based on what intervention leads to a repetition of the behavior. So it might be that the parrot really likes you screaming at it, for example. So I'm not saying so much that this is about levels. It's more that I think there's room for nuance there. In part of analyzing a reward system also involves trying to understand, well, what does a reward actually look like for those who are a part of the system? And that might not be as straightforward as money. And there's been a bunch of HRM literature that's actually found that financial incentives are not as rewarding as other things like some public recognition or whatever it is for that cohort. So I think that there's room there to interpret rewards more broadly, but whether that's possible at a group level, I don't know. I guess through identification is how I'm seeing that mechanism play out potentially at a group level.
Yeah, I think so far we've talked more about the goals, so to say, what is being rewarded, but we talked less about what the reward in itself is. So, for example, in war, the reward obviously is not a bonus, but so, for example, you get to go home. This is not the kind of literature that I'm in. So I don't know how much within HRM literature, for example, they talk about, hey, maybe we should give different kinds of rewards to people. So, for example, that if you do a good job, I don't know, you get an extra day off, or I don't know.
Yeah, that's been a big part of the conversation in the last, I'd say, 10 to 20 years, is actually to differentiate how you reward people. And part of that is to actually understand your people so that you know what they value and can offer a tailored package. And that's seen as a big part of a retention strategy today.
Okay, I was going to also add, though, that rewards are something that we have to think a little bit more dynamically, because when we're talking about financial incentives and all of this, and what may work now, what may be rewarding or perceived as rewarding now, maybe a few months down the road or next year might no longer be seen as a reward, especially if it's something that everybody ultimately is able to acquire, and then not getting it is seen as a sanction instead. So the value associated with rewards is something that it's a bit dynamic, and this is why in some ways, I'm a little, the simplicity of the way that rewards are described in the article does leave me a little squeamish that say, okay, the soldier going home Yes, it always makes sense that that would be part of the reward. But then when you're talking about different wars, different types of wars, different types of senses of victory and all that sort of thing, especially if you're talking about if your nation is under existential threat, there's a lot else in the reward equation that perhaps outweighs one's or changes the calculus of one's own survival. So we have to think of rewards as being much more dynamic than the way it's presented here, I think.
I think so too. And in a way, he stresses this also in the really end of the article. So when he comes to the conclusions, he also provides three remedies in trying to alter the flawed reward system. And so he mentioned selection. So trying to select those newcoming employees that are aligned with the management or organizational goals. Training as a remedy, so trying to train, socialize employees in line with the goals. Make them consonant is what he stresses. And altering the reward system. So what if you... And then he gives some examples of what if you give a different choice architecture in the rewards offered, then would there be more alignment between the desired behavior that you wish as an organization? And I found this part of the article interesting, and yet also specifically the first two remedies that he offers, selection and training, they're very much focused on actually the motivation of people rather than the reward system itself. While I read the article as a critique on the reward system, so to me it's mostly the third remedy that's the main point to tackle if you want to correct this this folly between A and B.
And that concludes part one of episode 57. Thank you for listening, and we hope you enjoyed the discussion and found it valuable. If so, please tell your friends, colleagues, and students who may be interested in the podcast. You can also give us feedback, which we love to receive, via Twitter, Facebook, or through our website, www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. Please join us next time as we continue our discussion of CARE's classic work on reward systems, here on Talking About Organizations.